The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Professor William Easterly was for 16 years an economist at the World Bank.
I was in the research department, which by World Bank standards actually had a lot of intellectual freedom, but not quite enough.
And the World Bank has, for many years, had a problem with human rights. It didn't discuss them.
Was there a point at which at the World Bank you thought, I'm on the wrong side here, I've got to leave and maybe have the freedom to speak differently and to do this differently?
Well, one thing I remember is sometime in the mid-90s, going to an Africa region meeting. Now everyone around the table is sort of agreeing, hey, structural adjustment in Africa is really not working. And then the conclusion of the meeting is, we should keep doing it. And I was like, what is going on here? We know it's not working, yet we keep doing it. Why?
But since leaving the organization, Professor Easterly has had a change of heart.
So I'm sort of a recovering expert trying to spread the news to the other experts.
This is The Guardian's Liz Ford.
So we're at the Ending Sexual Violence in Conflict Summit that's being held at the Excel Centre in London.
You may remember that this was the event attended by Angelina Jolie. We sent Liz down earlier in the month to record this and some of the people attending that summit.
But I think there's probably a lot of people that are thinking, they're a little bit concerned that there's a strong focus on ending impunity, a strong focus on getting prosecutions, and not enough on the wider issues, as in women's economic empowerment.
When we teach them the human rights things, you know, the first thing comes how they can survive, how they can have access of the food in the evening, you know, that comes first, you know. So basic needs comes first for the widows, you know.
Women needs economic empowerment to have the whole world peace and stability.
Yes, they want justice, but getting somebody to court is not their priority. Their priority is getting a job, getting money, getting away from the actual abuse, supporting their children, getting them an education, getting decent healthcare, all those other things.
They talk about women political participation. They don't talk about economic empowerment. So it's all interlinked. And unless we address the issue holistically, then separate interventions will be ineffective.
So it begs the question, what comes first, economic empowerment to better your life or basic human rights? And why can't we talk about the two together? We'll find out on today's Global Development Podcast. I'm Hugh Muir. Stay with us. But first, back to Professor Easterly. He says vital development is blighted by technocrats. I caught up with him on the phone line from New York and asked him what was going wrong.
I think it's because there's this fascination in development with development is an exclusively technical problem. That is just about technical fixes like bed nets for malaria or medications for malaria or antibiotics for other health problems. And the reason these technical solutions have been neglected is because poor people are oppressed by autocrats who have no interest in their well-being. They only have an interest in staying in power. There was a World Bank project in Uganda that had the idea that this one district of Uganda called Mubende could be very profitably developed as a forestry project, and that forestry was the best use of the land. The World Bank, in this case, is sort of like the counterpart of the British colonial authorities deciding what is best. The farmers on the land who were growing their own food crops were not on board with this. And unfortunately, what happened was this was settled with violence. The company, a private company that the World Bank was working with to develop this project, hired security forces who came in and marched the farmers off at gunpoint, burned down their homes, burned down their crops. An 8-year-old child died in the fire that happened to this. The farmers were kept at gunpoint from rescuing the child or their own homes. And the farmers were marched off, 20,000 farmers were marched off at gunpoint and said, this land is no longer yours. This is this kind of tragedy that happens when we neglect the rights of the poor, that you do something that you think is making them better off, and it's actually making people worse off because you did not give them the right to consent. You did not respect their right to consent.
It's difficult though, isn't it? Because you have big organisations who hope to help with big budgets, but obviously you're kind of wary of just handing that money over, want to know that it's being done properly. Isn't there a limit to the extent to which you can work from bottom up? Isn't it almost inevitable there'll be some element of top down?
Well, if you're saying that you need to sort of work with the governments that are there, even if they're authoritarian, I think that is the perennial dilemma in the aid business. And I don't want to say there's any easy answer to that. There is not an easy answer. I mean, I think certainly to begin to come to an answer, you certainly do want to cut off governments that are simply using your own aid money for their own repression. And I think the more important thing that has happened as a result of that discussion is the official aid community has just decided that we're sort of not allowed to talk about autocracy and oppressive governments because this issue is so unsolvable. And so there's a sort of unintentional censorship of the big debate that we should be having in development. You know, is autocracy itself one of the main causes of poverty?
The likes of Bill Gates and Jeffrey Sachs have looked at the things that you're saying and have made the point that you might be ignoring some of the big success stories in modern aid, things like the polio immunisation programme, things that I suppose that can only be done by big organisations that go into a country, things that in a way are best done from the top down.
You know, I've never said aid always fails. There are successes in aid, even in very top-down aid, and because there are some problems that are more amenable to top-down aid intervention. And I think the one you mentioned is exactly at the most common one. In fact, it's the one that's polio and other vaccination programs is the one that is cited over and over again by Gates and Sachs and other aid defenders. Why do they have that? Why are they stuck with only this one example that they cite over and over again or only a few other examples? It's because, you know, there was this one problem that was more amenable to top-down aid, and it got solved. That's great. I'm glad it happened, but it's not the way the whole world of development works.
What if we were to, you've obviously shaken things up, what if we were to ignore your detractors and made you king for the day? How would things be different? There's a calibration to be done here. How would you calibrate things differently?
We need sort of like a Copernican revolution in development. What's really been happening is we placed ourselves, the aid and development experts, are kind of the whole center of development. And we obsess with this sort of what should we do question of what the Western efforts should be, which is, you know, very understandable. And I want the West to continue to do good things. But we're not at the center of development. The Copernican revolution would recognize that it's poor people themselves who are at the center of development, and they are already successfully developing themselves. There's already been tremendous successes in development that are homegrown, that are due to the efforts of poor societies, poor people and poor societies asserting their own rights themselves. And we should not have the arrogance that everything in development revolves around us, the experts. That's really most, you know, fundamentally at the end of the day, I protest against most, this arrogance and this egocentricity and self-centeredness that we place ourselves, the experts, the whole center of global development. And that's not, we don't deserve that. We're not at the center. We're very marginal. It's poor people themselves who are developing themselves.
Professor William Easterly, author of The Tyranny of Experts, and that's available now. Professor Easterly talked about countries being helped to help themselves. Let's consider the case of Somaliland. Mark Anderson reports.
Somaliland is the world's fourth poorest country, if it was a country. But it's not, because no one in the international community recognizes Somaliland as a sovereign state, and it receives no direct aid. You might think Somaliland would be held back by this lack of aid, but it's actually done very well. There's been two presidential elections which passed without incident, and the international observers of those elections were so enamored with Somaliland's case for recognition that they founded an NGO specifically to champion Somaliland's cause. In Somaliland's capital, Hargeisa, Hibo Mohamed Ise has been running a small catering business. It's been going 2 years.
Yeah, we are cooking refreshments for meetings, like the police, like the government. Also, we're receiving orders from homes, weddings. So me, I like Somaliland and living here.
Everybody's coming back to Somaliland.
If you see back to 10 years,
for example, in the shops of the hotels, there's no more than 10 hotels in Hargeisa. But now you cannot count the number of hotels in Hargeisa, as well as the printing press, shops. Everywhere you go, there's a small business. So there's a lot of people in Hargeisa now. So as much as the people is there, and they are buying with no war, with no anything that they are afraid of. So I can say it's growing.
But not everyone is as positive as Hibo. Somaliland has come under fire from rights groups for attacks on journalists and poor treatment of Ethiopian and Somali migrants who passed through Somaliland on their way to Yemen. But few can argue with Somaliland's stable democracy and thriving businesses like Hibo's. It's doing far better than its neighbors to the south.
If you see how the freedom and the democracy that has taken place in Somaliland, I can say even it's best than so many countries in Africa. Whenever the problem is happening, there's a fight. I never stopped. But Somaliland has reached a level that we have the ability to stop war and to establish a peace.
Hibo Mohamed Essay in Hargeisa. So we've heard plenty of examples of where aid is going wrong and going right. And with me now to pick through some of these ideas, we have something of an international lineup. From Washington, Jessica Evans of Human Rights Watch. She's a senior researcher in their business and human rights division. And in Geneva, we have Jyoti Ghosh, professor of economics at Nehru University, New Delhi, and the Executive Secretary of International Development Economics Associates. Welcome to both of you. Jyoti, let me start with you. This is basically what Professor Eastley talks about in his book, The Tyranny of Experts. It refers to Somaliland, which is an economy that's benefited from improved human rights and democracy. And here's the important thing, without the technocrats getting involved. Is that a phenomenon that you recognise?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that technocrats have been particularly successful, certainly in the international development industry. But I wouldn't say that's because they are technocrats per se. I would argue that, number one, they're divorced from the particular domestic conditions. But more than that, they are all influenced by a rather stale and mechanical paradigm of how economies should be run, which I really think is counterproductive. The so-called Washington Consensus, which should have died several decades ago, is back and alive and kicking, and unfortunately still being imposed all over the world, regardless of context, regardless of usefulness, and regardless of notions of economic democracy.
Jessica, to what extent do you think we can hold Somaliland up as a model of good practice?
I can't speak directly to Somaliland, but one thing that we constantly see is that development is not understood in the same way as it should be. So sustainable development, we believe, is freedom from fear and want for all without discrimination. Sustainable development should be about the creation of conditions in which people everywhere can realize their civil and political rights, as well as their economic, social, and cultural ones. I think what Professor Easterly is pushing for here is for increased recognition of civil and political and some economic rights, and that being the basis for development. I think Human Rights Watch and many human rights advocates would go that step further to say that development needs to be grounded in all of the human rights that we've been fighting for.
Jyoti, talk to me about the balance, the ratio, if you like, of human rights to economic development, economic empowerment. Is the balance right?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the big problems I see, both in, you know, the international, shall we say, the multilateral community, as well as in many developing countries today, is that in a sense, there's a kind of trade-off. We are told by many of our governments, my own at the moment, but a number of others across the world, that look, we're going to give you growth and development. We'll try and give you electricity and roads and water and so on. And in return for that, just shut up and do what we tell you. In other words, you know, don't ask for higher wages. Don't complain if you're displaced by a project. Don't worry about environmental standards. Don't worry about workers' rights and living wages, because these are all costs you have to pay for this grand process of development.
Jessica, does that ring a bell with you? And if so, give us some examples of where that's been the case, that's been how things have unfolded.
One example that comes to mind is the World Bank's engagement with Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is anything but a democratic country, and human rights violations are really widespread. One particularly problematic industry within Uzbekistan is the cotton industry, which is grounded in a system of forced labor. Every year, the government mobilizes over a million of its citizens, including including children, to pick cotton. What the World Bank has recently, just earlier this month, approved is an irrigation project, which is going to directly benefit the cotton industry. It's going to provide water to cotton farms. And while the World Bank has, as a positive development, taken some moves to mitigate these risks of forced labor, it's not doing anything to actually dismantle that system, which continues and will continue with this project. So the World Bank has, for instance, put in place third-party monitors to look at whether there is forced labor on the areas within which the project is being carried out. But on the other side, the World Bank has done nothing to ensure that independent journalists and civil society organizations, which often monitor the cotton harvest, can do so even with respect to the land on which the World Bank is financing an irrigation project. So this shows, I think, how in some respects the World Bank is willing to recognize what we would consider human rights risks, but not willing to go that extra step to work toward an environment in which Uzbek citizens can themselves work to realize their own human rights.
Jyoti, what's your sense of the role or the balance that's being struck by the World Bank?
Well, you know, the World Bank, I don't believe, is really the most important player anymore in many developing countries. Certainly, it is still promoting projects that are, shall we say, inconsistent with some of these goals that Jessica mentioned. But really, when you're looking at patterns of investment or even patterns of control over social dissent and all of that, it's really not the World Bank that is the most important player anymore. And I think we have to be much more concerned about how the international rules, treaties, whether it comes from the bilateral investment treaties, whether it comes from the GATT rules or WTO and so on, whether these actually impact on the policy space that governments have to promote the rights of citizens, and also the governments themselves, how concerned are they in terms of ensuring this balance? I'd like to give one example from India, if I may. You know, we've had very recently, after the new government came to power in India, we've had a report published by the Intelligence Bureau, which is really supposed to be something that's out there spying for the country, supposedly. Anyway, the Intelligence Bureau has come out with a report saying that social movements and NGOs that have been fighting about the concerns of people who are displaced by projects, and those who are worried about the impact of nuclear projects, the environmental impacts and so on, they are essentially anti-national, against national security interests. And amazingly, they've come up with a figure saying they're losing the country 3% of GDP per year. Now, the fact that an intelligence bureau can come out with a report like this is mind-boggling. And it's also deeply worrying because it suggests that the government can now use this as a way of getting after these NGOs and social movements and preventing the kind of popular dissent that would force the government to respect human rights.
Jessica, the World Bank, this is kind of your start of a 10, isn't it? Because I know the Human Rights Watch published a report last year about what the World Bank should be doing about human rights. I mean, just give us some specifics about where they're falling down now.
Sure. So the World Bank has typically seen human rights as beyond its purview, which is incredibly troubling considering it is a leading development agency. I agree with Jyoti that the World Bank finance, as compared to other finance, is decreasing in proportions, and that governments, whether they be governments that are receiving donor aid or governments that are giving them, are also incredibly important actors when it comes to realizing human rights. But the World Bank itself is not held accountable to international human rights standards. Instead, it creates its own policies that are internal and holds itself accountable to those policies. Therefore, it's operating outside of the international human rights framework, which is incredibly problematic. To give you one very recent example, just today, Human Rights Watch has published a report in Tajikistan on resettlements linked to the Rogan Dam, which is set to be the highest dam in the world. The World Bank has provided financing looking at both the environmental and the social impacts of this dam. But unfortunately, although the World Bank looks at the degree to which international environmental and water laws are being complied with, it doesn't even touch on international human rights law, including the obligations of the Tajik government that the government itself has signed up to.
What about people who say, you have to strike a balance? What's the greater good? Is it to have these considerations about human rights, or is it to get money to places where people desperately need that money? And that maybe too much concentration on human rights is a bit of a luxury.
I think that's creating a false dichotomy here. The international financial institutions and donors can work with governments to create development projects which do respect human rights. They can ensure that communities have the opportunity to meaningfully participate in crafting their own development agendas, and then they can work with those communities and with the governments to finance them. It's not a question of whether we go in or not. It's a question of how the international institutions can use their own leverage to support the human rights of people within developing countries.
Now, of course, Jyoti Ghosh, the World Bank may not be the only player in town for long, because, of course, China has announced plans to launch a global development institution to rival the World Bank. How, if at all, do you think that will change the dynamic?
I think it will change the dynamic in an important way, in that, in fact, the World Bank has been less significant in all development and investment and infrastructure investment now for several decades. But we haven't really had significant expansion of the regional banks, and the Asian Development Bank really hasn't stepped up to the plate as required. So if the Chinese are actually willing to put their money where their mouth is and dramatically increase this kind of funding, it will definitely have an impact. But I would like to highlight another player who I think is being ignored in this. Most development investment, so-called, today is in private hands. It's by multinational companies. And this is part of a broader policy stance that has been actively encouraged by the multilateral institutions themselves and by the WTO and others. And we are ignoring the impact that this kind of investment has on human rights. We now have increasing numbers of cases where you have multinational companies that have actually trampled on the rights of local communities and are able to get away with it because of either bilateral investment treaties or regional trade agreements that include investment chapters that effectively protect them through the investor protection clauses, or simply by the operation of U.S. courts, which has actually dramatically altered the power balance and limited the ability, even when governments want to ensure the realization of human rights.
So, Jessica, corporations play a big role here. Do you think we should be doing more to regulate what they do?
Absolutely. And actually, we have an opportunity at the moment to do just that. The post-2015 agenda on development is currently being negotiated. And this provides an opportunity to finally bring into the realm corporate accountability. There is a draft Goal 8, which is currently out there, of the Sustainable Development Goals. And one way that we can massively improve this goal, which is directed at promoting strong, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth and decent work for all, is by including in it a commitment to introduce mandatory requirements on corporations to undertake human rights due diligence around their work and publicly report on their human rights, social and environmental impacts, as well as payments that they make to domestic or foreign governments, which is essential to counter corruption.
Okay, we've talked a lot in the past few minutes about the World Bank. I should say that we did ask the World Bank for a contribution, but they weren't able to give us one for this podcast. But, Jyoti, let me ask you, do you think that they do a lot in this area, obviously, and face a lot of criticism? Is that fair?
No, I think it's certainly fair, but I think they shouldn't be the only targets of criticism. I think there's a lot that the World Bank does that is really quite wrong, and that they should be much more accountable and responsive to the criticism. But really, as I mentioned earlier, they are not the big players anymore. The big players are the rules that are set up by the international treaties and the multinational corporations who, as Jessica mentioned, are really currently not legally accountable at all. So I think we need to take much more cognizance of the fact that we have a bit of a free-for-all globally in terms of the lack of power of the human rights agenda relative to the investor protection agenda. And we need to rectify that imbalance.
Okay, well, thank you both. That's all we have time for on that bit of our debate. But thanks to Jyoti Ghosh, Professor of Economics at Nehru University, New Delhi, and to Jessica Evans of Human Rights Watch, the senior researcher in their Business and Human Rights Division, for their contributions. This edition of the Global Development Podcast was produced by Matt Hill, assisted by Mark Anderson. Don't forget, you can have your say at theguardian.com/global-development. Just click on the link and voila, you'll get your podcast. Thank you for listening. I hope it was illuminating. My name's Hugh Muir. Until next time, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With World Cup fever taking over, we at The Guardian are pretty sure that you're thinking big too. So maybe now is the time to use Squarespace to create your own professional website for your small business, portfolio or blog. It's easy. You could create your own site during halftime. Just go to squarespace.com to start your free trial. And to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.